23-7864, Darryl Brown versus Letitia James, Anthony Annucci et al. And good morning. We have Ms. Is it Santillo or Santillo?
Santillo.
Santillo. Ms. Santillo, I understand you would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Kristen Santillo on behalf of petitioner appellant Darryl Brown. Mr. Brown's federal due process rights were violated.
You adjust your microphone a bit.
Is this okay?
Good.
Mr. Brown's federal due process rights were violated when the state trial court refused to instruct the jury on justification, when the trial record, viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Brown, as New York law requires, supported a self-defense justification instruction. Because justification was Mr. Brown's only defense, the trial court's refusal to give the instruction was catastrophic to the defense. It assured his conviction by preventing the jury from crediting his defense. And therefore, Mr. Brown meets the standards set forth by the Supreme Court in Cupp v. Naughton. Now, it's crystal clear under New York law that a justification instruction is required whenever any reasonable view of the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant supports the defense. The Appellate Division First Department, in overturning Mr. Brown's conviction, carefully combed the record and marshaled the facts and decided that a reasonable jury could conclude that Mr. Brown was acting in self-defense. The Court of Appeals then reversed the First Department's decision, and when it did so, it drew numerous facts against Mr. Brown when New York law required that they be drawn in his favor. This court's precedents have established that in Davis, in Jackson, and Rodriguez established that when the New York State Court draws inferences against a defendant when they were required to be drawn in his favor, and if they had been drawn in his favor, a justification instruction would have been required. That implicates due process. And if it affects the trial sufficiently, it requires reversal.
Can I direct your attention to the standard of review that we as federal judges are obliged to apply to this? Because your client's case comes before us on a habeas claim under 2254. And...
Thank you.
My understanding of the standard that the Supreme Court has laid out is, well, we're not allowed to grant relief unless the state's adjudication resulted in a decision that involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has said unreasonable application means something different from an incorrect application, right? It means something more egregiously wrong, not just wrong, but unreasonably wrong. And it has also been described, as I understand, as a decision by the state court so lacking in justification that there was an error well understood and comprehended in existing law beyond any possibility for fair-minded disagreement. So when thinking about that, I looked, and it seemed that if you add up the number of judges who have looked at this issue, starting with the state trial court is one, the appellate division, there were two judges who dissented, who viewed this against you. Seven, it was all the Court of Appeals was unanimous, and they have seven, and then the magistrate judge and the district court below, that I tally up 12 jurists who have taken a contrary view, and three, the majority of the appellate division who have taken your client's view. And I guess I ask how, when we look at that, can our court conclude that fair-minded jurists could not disagree on this? Because that's what the standard is. So tell me first if I'm misstating the standard. And second, tell me how you perceive the repeated adjudications of every level as not militating in favor of a conclusion in favor of your adversary that you may be right. The trial court may have gotten this wrong, but not unreasonably wrong.
Well, Your Honor, the question under New York law is whether on any reasonable view of the evidence, the fact finder might have decided that the defendant's actions were justified.
Right.
Now, Your Honor just laid out 12 people who looked at this, and three of them decided that Mr. Brown might have been justified. To me, that means that on any reasonable view of the evidence, at least three fact finders who would have been required in order to convict Mr. Brown could have debated in the jury room whether or not he used self-defense, and there was evidence from which a reasonable juror could have come to the conclusion that he was acting in self-defense. New York law is very clear that if there is any reasonable view of the evidence where the fact finder might have decided the actions were justified, a justification instruction is required.
But on appellate review, this circuit has said that it will grant relief only if the state's court ruling deprived the defendant of a highly credible defense. So even assuming the testimony of that one witness, the mailman, was sufficient to warrant a justification defense or the defense of self-defense to the jury, even if that were true, how do we provide the relief if the defendant ultimately was not deprived of a highly credible defense? Because under New York law, you are not justified in pulling a weapon in defense of, you know, don't bring a gun to a fist fight. You're not allowed to be the initial aggressor. You're not allowed to first under the elements of the justification defense, the level of force used has to be commensurate, right? The subjective objective. And then there are the exceptions to self-defense, initial aggressor, duty to retreat. So even if the jury had received a justification defense, how do you show that that would have been a credible or highly credible defense given the facts of this case? Do you see what I mean? In other words, they may have gotten it wrong, but...
Well, so the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Brown establishes a highly credible justification defense. Now, Mr. Brown was a corrections officer who was carrying a licensed firearm that was issued by the corrections department. The evidence showed that he was not the aggressor, the initial person to use affirmative force. He was in a discussion argument with Mr. Cabbagestock. Mr. Cabbagestock started swinging punches at his face with both his hands, with closed fists.
Is that the standard under New York law, who first used force? I thought it was use or threat. And I thought the question for initial aggressor is whether who first threatened deadly physical force. Is that not the standard?
The question is who first threatened the imminent use of deadly physical force.
Right. Okay,
and
good.
That's the key question. Because Mr. Brown, who was lawfully possessed of the firearm and did not have it brandished when he entered into the discussion, and the record is crystal clear that he did not draw his firearm until after Mr. Cabbagestock was swinging multiple times at his face. He was trying to, a third party was trying to restrain Mr. Cabbagestock. And then when Mr. Brown drew the firearm, he did not point it at Mr. Cabbagestock at the moment that the Court of Appeals found that he was the initial aggressor.
Well, I thought the evidence was he pointed it at an angle. And no, you could kill somebody by shooting them in the leg.
It was not pointed in the direction of Mr. Cabbagestock. It was pointed at an angle And Mr. Wolf, who's the postman, testified and clarified his testimony in when he was cross-examined. He said that he was not pointing it in the direction of Mr. Cabbage Stalk, and that he was not threatening him with it. He specifically used that language. And so the only way to get to the conclusion that he was imminently trying to use physical force is if drawing a firearm, displaying a firearm, is always going to be the threatened physical force.
I thought the law was that, and it's always the prosecution's burden, never the defense's burden, right? It's the prosecution's burden to disprove the defense of justification. But that the first part of the test is that the defendant subjectively thought, your client subjectively thought that the use of deadly physical force was imminent, and that the objective part of the test is that a reasonable person in the circumstances he found himself in would have felt the imminent threat of deadly physical force. And if that's the case, then you look at the level of force used to respond to that. But where is the evidence that subjectively or objectively the circumstances your client found himself in would have established that he felt the imminent threat? Where was the evidence, imminent deadly physical force, not force in general?
So when Mr. Brown first drew the firearm in a defensive posture, our position is he did not threaten the imminent use of deadly physical force. In fact, there's a statement that Mr. Cabbage Stalk makes, which he says, if you're going to pull a gun, you better use it. And the prosecution in sentencing argued, oh, maybe he just said that. He said that to back him down. He clearly didn't think he was going to use the gun. Right. He was using the gun to de-escalate in self-defense. In fact, he put it on an expert that said that showing the firearm and asking people to stop, it can be used as a tactic to de-escalate an encounter. Now, Mr. Cabbage Stalk himself said, you're going to pull the gun, you better use it, and swiped for the gun at the same time. Then that is the first threat of imminent use of deadly force, because the threat accompanied by the swipe put him in apprehension that the gun was going to be wrestled away from him and he would be shot by Mr. Cabbage Stalk.
But you're only allowed to use deadly force if you're faced with deadly force. So I'm struggling with how your client being the first one to pull the gun doesn't preclude that defense.
There is no law that states that if you just pull a firearm defensively to de-escalate an encounter, that constitute the threatened imminent use of deadly physical force. All of those elements have to be there. So there are cases in New York that say displaying a gun, if it's not pointed at somebody, is not force at all. There are some that say that it can be ordinary force to display it. And then you have to look at the circumstances under which it's used. And that's in the definition of deadly physical force. It says, deadly physical force means physical force which, under the circumstances in which it is used, is readily capable of causing death or serious injury. And so the circumstances here, a trained correctional officer, a legally possessed firearm, holding the gun by witness's own account, pointed away from Mr. Cabbage Stalk, and not aimed at him, not threatening him. Those were Mr. Wolf's words, that he was not pointing it or threatening. So I think in that situation, he was not using deadly physical force. So the fact that, you know, I just disagree with the premise that he was the first, he introduced deadly physical force at that moment.
So
it was only when this.
Ms. Santilli, you've reserved 3 minutes, unless there are any further questions right now. Yes.
Little question. In this very case, that is the case of your client, under these circumstances, this went all the way to the New York Court of Appeals, right?
Yes.
And the New York Court of Appeals in this very situation held against you. Do you know of any case that suggests that we can grant habeas relief because we disagree with a state high court's application of state law?
Yes, I think that there's several principles that establish that. In Jackson, I believe it's Jackson or Davis, the court, you know, states the notion that, here, I have it right here. You know, the principle at issue here is that once states have promulgated laws to define criminal conduct, federal due process protects a defendant from conviction unless he is shown in a fair proceeding to have violated those laws. That principle is equally applicable to intermediate appellate courts and to the highest court. As we cited in our briefs, in this court's cases that have reversed New York state courts when they have drawn inferences against the defendants when they should have been drawn in their favor. And if the inferences had been drawn in their favor, they would have found for the defendant. In those cases, they cite other cases in other districts where those courts have reversed the highest court in the state because they did not fairly apply the law. And the thing about justification that makes it different is that when it's properly interposed, it becomes an element of the offense. And when that happens, it is the prosecution's burden to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And so if you should have had the justification instruction given, and if it wasn't, then the government never had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the elements of the offense. That's a well-recognized federal due process violation. And we don't think, you know, as we said in our papers, that the New York court was purporting to reinterpret New York state law. What it was doing was applying the facts to the well-settled law, but it did so incorrectly.
Which decision in the New York courts are we reviewing in your view? Are we reviewing the district court's decision that a justification defense was not warranted? Or are we reviewing the New York Court of Appeals decision that the trial court did not err?
So I think the three-part test that's articulated in Davis. First, you're just asking the question of whether a justification instruction was required. Second, whether it affected the trial. The third is where the deference might come in to the court. And I believe that it is fair to say that there would be some deference that would be applied to the Court of Appeals decision, which I think is before this court. But I think that if, you know, there have been cases where the courts have said that if you draw inferences against a defendant when they should have been drawn in his favor, that is unreasonable.
Okay.
That's objectively unreasonable.
All right. We have allocated 3 minutes for rebuttal, so we will hear from you again. Why don't we hear from counsel for the appellee, Mr. Juan?
May it please the court, Charles Juan for the respondent. Your Honor, the first step in the review is whether petitioner was entitled to a justification charge under state law. And here, New York Court of Appeals made an authoritative interpretation of state law that petitioner was the initial aggressor, having displayed gun in a incident where the victim was unarmed, and therefore he was the initial aggressor and was not entitled to a justification charge. This is the state's highest court interpreting state law, and therefore is binding upon federal courts. And ultimately,
well, if they engaged in an objectively unreasonable interpretation of their own law, are you saying that we would be powerless to review that under 2254?
No, I mean, if the state court's ruling, I guess if it was found to be unconstitutional in some way, like voided for vagueness or some other reasons, this court obviously would not be bound by it.
Well, let me give you an example. Let's say the facts here were different. So imagine my hypothetical. There are 16 eyewitnesses with video cameras, and they show someone with a machine gun starts charging at, say, the defendant here, who at that point had not, didn't have any gun, no weapon at all. And then after someone charges at him with a machine gun, the defendant pulls out a gun and shoots him. And let's say then the court of New York Court of Appeals says, no, there's no right to a self-defense charge. Wouldn't that be an unreasonable, a patently unreasonable application of state law? I mean, we can read the state law. We say that's just bizarre.
Your Honor, our argument is not that.
No, so just stick with my hypothetical.
Yes,
I'm just trying to understand the bounds. You seem to be suggesting that by virtue of the fact that we're reviewing the New York Court of Appeals, that we have no power to grant 2255 relief. But that seems like an awfully broad proposition that would seem to insulate every state Supreme Court, any case reviewed by a state Supreme Court from ever being subject to 2254 relief. Can that possibly be?
No, my argument is not that Court of Appeals decisions are always cannot be reviewed on habeas appeal.
Okay.
What our argument is that interpretation of state statute, if under your honor's hypothetical, if the Court of Appeals just said defendant in that case is not entitled to a justification defense, that was it. That would just be basically applying the state law. So then it would be a review as to whether it was clearly erroneous. But if the
clearly erroneous, or I thought it was unreasonable application of clearly established law.
Well, I meant just under the first step of the reviewing whether the jury charge, it would be clearly erroneous, and then we would go on to the step two, which is prejudicial, and then the final analysis would be, is it objectively unreasonable?
Okay.
My point just really was, under your hypothetical, if the Court of Appeals is just basically just saying defendant was not entitled to a justification charge, that would just be merely applying state law. And so it would be applicable to APA standard review. And the ultimate standard would be, was it objectively unreasonable? But here, the Court of Appeals did not merely just say defendant was not entitled to a justification charge. It specifically said on the state statute, his actions rendered him initial aggressor.
But is that the accurate interpretation of the law? Because my understanding of self-defense, justification defense, is there are elements, the subjective objective part of the test, elements to self-defense, and then there are exceptions. Even if you can show that you subjectively, you were reasonable in your subjective belief that imminent deadly physical force was about to be used against you, and that was a reasonable belief under the objective standard, and you responded with that same level of force, then there are exceptions where you still can't use self-defense. When you're the initial aggressor, you're the first to initiate the deadly physical force or threat thereof. Or you had a duty to retreat if you're in a jurisdiction where there's a duty to retreat, or you had an agreement for combat, or there are other exceptions. In Connecticut, for example, there's the in addition to being the initial aggressor, you provoked that level of force. I understand New York doesn't have that same statute, but what if we have an unreasonable interpretation of the statute? And I want to draw a hypothetical that's actually closer to the facts of this case. I reviewed the sentencing transcript in this case, and the defendant in his remarks to the court said, I thought he was going to kill me. He beat up my daughter, or allegedly had hurt his daughter while she was pregnant with their child, and that was the nature of the dispute. And he made statements that he feared for his life. And the trial judge said, well, that didn't come out in evidence. That didn't come out. And therefore, that would have been a different story. What if, and I'm sure there are strategic reasons whether a defendant chooses to testify or not during the trial, what if the defendant had actually taken the stand and said, you know, I pulled out my gun because I thought he was going to kill me? Would that have been enough to instruct the jury on justification?
No, Your Honor. That would certify.
Why not?
That would certify that defendant had the subjective belief, but it still has to be that his belief is objectively reasonable.
You don't have to prove that your justification defense is going to be successful. You just have to raise enough evidence, and the trial judge, as the gatekeeper and as who decides what instructions are appropriate under the record before it, can makes that assessment. In this case, I understood the judge to say the testimony of the postman who was delivering mail was not sufficient evidence in that court's view, even read in a light most favorable to the defendant, to justify giving the justification defense. And then at sentencing, the court said, well, that would have been a different story. And my question to you is, is it a reasonable application of or interpretation of New York law to say, ultimately, if you're the initial aggressor, you're not even allowed to present the defense to the jury? Do you see what I'm saying? You're not allowed to have the instruction. Is that a determination that the court makes or a jury makes?
That's a determination the court makes, Your Honor, because under the state statute, if you're the initial aggressor, you're not entitled to the justification defense. So if there's an issue
as to a matter of law, not as a matter of fact. Okay.
Because that's a that's a legal interpretation. Are you an initial aggressor or not? Under your hypothetical, even if defendant said the victim had in the previous occasions beat on my daughter, it still doesn't mean that an original person would not necessarily believe that the victim was posing imminent physical threat there, because state law has always said basically punches do not equal imminent threat or deadly physical force, unless there's some other testimony from the defendant about how that the victim might have wielded weapons in the past or something like that. Then it might have been a different story, but just basically that he had punched his daughter in the past does not equal to deadly physical force.
So can I tease apart what I think might be two strands of your argument? And I think you tell me if I'm accurately characterizing what I think you're arguing. First, that the New York Court of Appeals' legal interpretation of what it means under New York law to be an initial aggressor, that's binding on us, because that's simply a question of what defenses are available under New York law. And the idea that the first person to threaten deadly force is under New York law an initial aggressor, and therefore is not entitled to raise a defense of justification, that's a matter of New York law. That's not open to our scrutiny. But the facts here of whether those facts under that settled interpretation qualified him for the defense, that's something that we would review under the AEDPA standard of 2254 only for unreasonable application of that law. Am I fairly capturing what I think you're arguing, or tell me if I'm missing a nuance?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the interpretation of state law would be binding on the federal courts, but if this court decides that the Court of Appeals was merely applying state law, then the ultimate question would all fair-minded jurors disagree with the Court of Appeals' decision? And as pointed out, I don't think that's been proven, since most of the jurists who have looked at it have said Court of Appeals was correct. If there are no further questions, people request an affirmance.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Santillo, if you would like, you have 3 minutes of rebuttal to add anything.
Yes, Your Honor, I just wanted to note that the Court of Appeals expressly stated that it wasn't trying to, interpret New York law. It was applying settled principles, including that the inferences should be drawn against or in Mr. Brown's favor, but it didn't do so. In fact, I'm just going to point to 5 inferences that were drawn against Mr. Brown when they could have and should have been drawn in his favor. One was that his act of drawing his service firearm could only be understood as an imminent threat of deadly physical force. When, we noted, Mr. Wolf testified that the gun was held at his waist, pointed away from Mr. Cabbage Stalk. he specifically said it was pointed in the direction. He did not see the gun pointed in the direction of the younger person and threatening him. Now, that could definitely be viewed as a defensive display of the firearm intended to de-escalate, particularly in the hands of a trained corrections officer, where there was expert testimony that that is what they are trained to do, to de-escalate. He said there was only the second thing the court drew against Mr. Brown was there was only a verbal altercation unaccompanied by physical threats before he pulled his gun. That is not true. Mr. Wolf testified specifically that he did not see a gun come out until multiple punches had been swung. He said things had already escalated in the hallway before he drew his gun, and that the parties already started tussling before Mr. Brown drew his gun. The Court of Appeals said that Mr. Cabbage Dog had the subjective belief that Brown was about to use the gun when he said, "You're going to pull a gun out, you better use it." And that was part of the Court of Appeals decision, that Mr. Cabbage Dog believed that he was about to imminently use deadly physical force. But in the sentencing transcript Your Honor read, the trial prosecutor specifically said that that inference or that statement, "You're going to pull a gun out, you better use it," was an indication by Mr. Cabbage Dog that he didn't think the defendant would do anything. And he was taunting him and he was threatening him. And the Appellate Division First Department took that same language and viewed it as a threat, that he was going to take the gun from Mr. Brown and he was going to use it against him. That would be the evidence drawn in favor of Mr. Brown. The fourth is the sequence. The First Department basically, the Court of Appeals said that as soon as Mr. Cabbage Dog made that threat, "You're going to take the gun out, you better use it," Mr. Brown then fired the shot and suggested there was no intervening time between the time that he fired the shot and the time that Mr. Brown shot the gun. And that was, there was a disputed sequence. And the government's argument when it went up to the Court of Appeals was that at that moment, when Mr. Cabbage Dog was swiping for the gun and threatening, Mr. Brown was arguably justified in the contemporaneous use of deadly force at that moment, but he actually walked away. And later, things cooled off and then he didn't have the right to use deadly physical force. So there was a more favorable inference that could have been drawn by the Court of Appeals based on the prosecution's own brief before the Court of Appeals and their theory of the case. They disregarded that and found against Mr. Brown. The last one was that there was no evidence that Mr. Brown withdrew after drawing the gun. Your Honor noted that there's certain exceptions. Well, even if initially when he drew the gun, he had, you know, that made him the initial aggressor, there was evidence he walked away. The prosecution's entire theory of the case was that he walked away after the gun. They tried to use that to say, like, oh, there was time to cool off. But Mr. Brown, drawing the inference in favor of Mr. Brown, he could have, established that he tried to walk away and Mr. Cabbage Dog pursued him. And he was afraid because he had threatened him earlier that he was going to overtake him, take his gun and use it against him. And that's why he developed the reasonable belief that Mr. Cabbage Dog was going to kill him. So I think that it's unreasonable in this court's precedence. You look at Davis, you look at Harris, Jackson. When the court draws inferences against a defendant when they needed to be drawn in his favor under state law, this court has found relief. And I think that in this case, this is an error that mattered. Mr. Brown's counsel opened saying this was about self-defense, self-preservation. All the questions were directed towards that. The prosecution hammered in summation. This is not about self-preservation. This is not a justification case. They wouldn't have had to do that if they weren't scared that the jury was going to consider it.
Thank you, Ms. Santillo. Thank you. I think we have your argument. I will thank both parties again for very helpful arguments on both sides. As with the other cases that we've had today, we will take the case under advisement. So with